to get you to believe that. And then by then, you know, they got the parents, they got the brothers and sisters, they got the, you know, the community and everybody behind you. And when you come back and say, look, it ain't like this, everybody else is like, what are you talking about? Don't blow this opportunity. That's what happens more often than not. It's almost like, you know, the abusive child. They don't say anything until they got the courage enough or the wisdom to say something. It's the same thing. So you get blinded by the gifts and the wanted attention and everybody praising you, but, you know, you're being abused behind closed doors.
Welcome to Going Deep, sports in the 21st century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John has coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
We're Team Shoup, and we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond sound bites and highlight reels. Today on Going Deep, sports in the 21st century, Marcia and I are going to continue our conversation with Ray Jackson and Jimmy King, two members of the University of Michigan's famous basketball team from the early 90s known to the world as the Fab Five.
And we'll also be joined by our friend Dr. Iago Colas, who was a professor at the University of Michigan for the last 20-plus years. Together, we'll dig deep into issues of systemic racism, hypocrisy, and the criminalization of being black. Hey, y'all.
Hey, Marcia.
How you doing?
Hey.
Did you and your family understand the business of college sports, of how recruiting worked?
Did your parents have a consciousness of what was happening, or did they kind of wake up to what was happening?
I think they all woke up. I can't speak for Jimmy's parents, but I know here in Austin, Texas, me being the first guy that was recruited that highly for basketball, having a Steve Fisher, John Thompson, those kind of guys coming to Austin, Texas, we didn't know what was before us. And I don't think we learned the dynamics of college sports and professional sports until it was too late. Like, we should have been able to capitalize off the Fab Five instantly. But I don't mean to sound crazy, but we were just happy to be in the situation initially until we saw until it was too late, until we realized that we missed out on something. Because if we, and Jimmy and I have talked about this recently, if I understood the business, I would have never went to University of Michigan. So I definitely know on my end, my family, we were green to the situation. We didn't have any real knowledge of the makeup or the dynamics of college or professional sports. I went to the school that I liked. I didn't go to the school that liked me the most and was willing to invest the most in me. So that's a big thing to me when dealing with kids now. So we definitely didn't know. We did not know. My family did.
I think one of the reasons that college sports is able to perpetuate this scenario of abuse, and frankly, that's what it is in so many ways, is because by the time young collegiate athletes realize what's going on, they're gone. Sometimes you don't realize, oh, nuts, hold on. They just made $1 billion off of my back. But by the time you realize it, you're 26 and out of school already, and it's hard to convince a guy that's there now. You know, I think it's really perceptive what you said, Ray, that while I was there, I didn't quite realize it.
Well, and the hook is your family's so excited for you. This is your big chance. That one of the things I've been trying to do in the last few years is really reach out to parents of high school students who were going to be recruited and say, listen, this is when you got some bargaining power, not after they sign that letter of intent, before they sign it. And, you know, so many parents don't think of it that way. They just think, oh, my kid, I'm so excited. My kid's got this big opportunity and we're just so grateful. Don't just be grateful. They aren't, you know, they're not doing you a favor. You're doing them a favor, you know.
Right.
And so, but that's a whole different way of families thinking. I don't know, Jimmy, if you have thoughts on that.
It's unfortunately the perception of being the recruiting game. So when you're being recruited by Michigan and, you know, they come to Austin, Texas, or the Plano, and they come into your high school, they come into the gym, so everybody from teachers to students to other parents to the community are excited. You know, everybody, the word is traveled through, you know, so it's like you have this opportunity, and the schools are smart. You know, these are institutions. They know this. They'll put you, they'll give you, tell you everything that you want to hear, tell them everything that they want to hear to get you there. Once you sign on the dotted line, it's free game. So you're either going to live with it or not. You're either going to be able to tough it out, or you're going to find a way to make it work, or, you know, you're going to change the scene, or, you know, whatever. Then it's the, for lack of better terms, the brainwashing of you represent this university. You are an extension of this university. No longer your family. They tell you your family's second, but they tell you you represent that the jersey first, and then your family is an extension. So they get you to believe that. And then by then, you know, they got the parents, they got the brothers and sisters, they got the, you know, the community and everybody behind you. And when you come back and say, look, it ain't like this, everybody else is like, what are you talking about? Don't blow this opportunity. That's what happens more often than not. And then a lot of times you got to think, like, you know, these men, young women who may not want to say anything. It's almost like, you know, the abusive child. They don't say anything until they got the courage enough or the wisdom to say something. It's the same thing. So you get blinded by the gifts and the wanted attention and everybody praising you, but, you know, you're being abused behind closed doors. And for the name of, or for the sake of, having an opportunity that most don't. So in reality, it's your opportunity and your talent that everybody else is cashing off on and into. And John, you hit it on the head. You're older and wiser by then. You know, it's hard to come back and tell somebody and families in those positions the situations, because then you look like you're bitter because it happened to you. But really, you're just, you know, educated and really trying to look out.
And what you just described, that whole thing you just described, that how embedded it is in the community, that's how collegiate sports is bundled up with racism in this country. That, to me, that what you just described is sort of this internalized narrative that we all have about what your only opportunity must be, you know,
right,
as a young black man. This is your chance.
Yeah.
And we've all just, that's been downloaded into our hard drive, you know, in this country since the very beginning. College sports is just another container for it, you know.
Right.
The way you just described
that,
it was
and
so,
you know,
vivid.
I'm sorry, not to cut you off, but you, that is 1,000% right.
Hey, John.
Oh, there you are.
Hey.
I'm here. I got you. So my name is Iago Colas, and I'm a professor of English at Oberlin College. But for the last 25 years, I've been a professor of comparative literature and the humanities at the University of Michigan, where I've taught courses and done research on sports studies including a special focus over the last few years on college sports, and specifically on the institutional, cultural, and athletic legacy of the Fab Five.
Well, can you comment a little bit, because political and social capital has a lot of food sources. So is there any social capital or political capital there on campus around the legacy of in terms of race and racism that this team embodies? I mean, after talking to Ray and Jimmy, I think these men are a part of the modern day civil rights movement. In terms of how they are able to name the powers and principalities and how they were used in that system and their whole awakening to that, and now what they have done with it to go back to kind of, you know, communities and families and help them to wake up to these systems of racism. We talked to them for an hour and a half. There was not one story about an overt kind of racist event that happened while they were at Michigan. But we talked about race a lot and how the systems of this country's racialized disadvantage are embedded in sports. And so is there any social capital to be generated around how they are really this pivotal moment, these five young men who sat in rooms and talked for hours about that they should use Malcolm X's X in their name? Is there any awareness of that?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's a lot that's interesting in what you just said. It's interesting that they did not mention any overt incidents of racism they encountered, because as anyone who's seen the documentary knows, that's actually something they did encounter.
Right, they
got letters from alumni. But it makes sense to me that they didn't mention it, because in all the conversations I've been a part of with them, especially over the last year or so, and there's been four or five in different public settings, their emphasis is always on systemic forms of racism.
Indeed, Ray, talk about the system.
Players don't wake up until it affects them. Like, it's not enough guys that go through the system, whether professionally or collegially, that make that stand instantly. Too many guys are scared to lose their spot at the table to make that sacrifice to educate the next generation coming through about the traps that are set up out here for their physically and mentally.
At the event last October, we had just at that time at Michigan had this experience on campus where the university community woke up to find white supremacist flyers kind of papered all over campus. And, you know, this was really traumatic for the whole campus, but obviously particularly for students of color. And so I decided to open the event by asking these guys if they had anything to tell the community. You know, anything they could share from their experience about this. And they had, with their response, students in tears that I could see, you know, from on stage in the audience. Students were so moved by the advice they were given. And it was challenging advice, because part of what they were saying was, you know, you cannot get caught up in battles over these kinds of incidents. You have to leverage your energy and your power for the larger, more systemic kinds of issues. And I think that there was a kind of energy and an uptick there around campus related to that social capital. But the problem, I think, is that what it's up against is, you know, Michigan's a big place. The athletic department is a powerful part of that institution. And the athletic department is very conservative, generally speaking. And so between the athletic department being conservative and being very wary of offending, I think, particularly alumni donors, and a kind of central administration that I think is wary of, as I think I shared with you, Marcia, when we were at Villanova, very wary of even taking on athletics at all, because they're so afraid of getting bogged down in a mire that will prevent them from getting other projects that are important to them kind of done. The odds are stacked against those students and faculty that I think have been trying to kind of get some momentum rolling behind the importance from a justice point of view, but just from the point of view of institutional integrity, of finding a way to commemorate the kind of multifaceted legacy of the team.
Ray and Jimmy, what do you think it would take for a team to get together and say, we're not playing until things change? Because they would change. If a team at a championship tournament or something like that said, we are not going to take the court if things don't change, they'd change. Because like you said, Missouri football said, we're not going to play unless things change. Guess what? The president was fired within 24 hours. Things changed.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
I think you gotta have at least, whether it's a coach, a player, someone that that is willing to give up something that they value.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But if you value you know, the game, and you love the game, and you're like, okay, we're not going to play this Saturday or in a championship tournament. And we're cool whether you know, like Colin Kaepernick, I'm cool if I don't play football again, but I want to speak out on the issue of police brutality in the United States. You have to be willing to accept whatever comes after that. And the problem with that is that, again, I think it's often looked at that, you know, you're throwing away an opportunity, and how dare you do that when you're the one who made it out, and you're ruining it for the people who come behind you, or you're muddling the message, or you're creating problems that they're going to take this away. You know, so I look at it like this. Like, I'm just trying to, like, provide for my family, forget that I ain't trying to rock the boat. You know, my lights are cut off, my family don't eat, I got an opportunity to get a $10 million contract, I'm not rocking the boat. So it's difficult to get everybody on that same page. And that's why you got to have coaches who you know, agree with the message, and because it'll stop. You know, it'll try to get cut down and chopped down when you're dealing with the institution, because the bottom line is the dollar.
In addition to that, an alternative has to be in place. Like, we need options. You can't, like, as long as not playing is our only option, that's going to continue to be a problem. We're not going to have anybody jump on board. A lot of these kids are here for the sport. We have to have outs in our scholarships to where we can go to another school, historically black college, and play instantly, and pull that same resource and financial resource to that university as well and not miss a beat. We need to have an out. So my thing is to have an alternative and educate. We have to be educated in the system and create a system that benefits the athletes too. These guys that are getting college degrees from these institutions have to get back in place to make a change in the system. We can't just run off and live our happy lives. We have to get in a position to where we can affect the system. If we don't do that and create options, then just boycotting is going to eventually play out and die out. We have to create options and educate as well. And yes, that is something that we're dealing with. With me working in the schools, a lot of our kids are not taught to research information. Right. They're taught to give. They're taught to take what's given to them. You understand? We never were raised with that approach in life. Okay, this is what they put on your plate. Find out if this is truth. Find out what's behind this, what made this happen, what created this situation. They take what's given on their plate for face value and move forward. Mm-hmm. You know, that goes back to what we were speaking about earlier, being a cultural thing. The culture has got to change. The educational process has to change. That level has to increase, or a lot of this to start changing. But and I'm gonna jump on out on a limb and say this for, as far as the college level, the black athlete could make a major change in how the system treats athletes, but it's going to take that one white athlete that's willing to take the extreme criticism from the powers that be and make a real change. That's as much as I hate to say it, that's the only way that it could dramatically change in our lifetime.
I think I could say the same thing in our country. Until white people understand and start to be willing to be transformed around race, it's not going to change. I mean, it's the white kind of investment, sometimes even unconscious investment in white supremacy, that keeps this whole deal going.
Chris Webber was the star Wolverine accused of breaking the NCAA rules. Could you quickly just say what it was Chris Webber was accused of?
Yeah, he received loans from a Detroit businessman named Ed Martin. Apparently they were received in his sophomore year, after the season had ended, and as you know, he only played 2 years at Michigan,
right?
And then he declared for the NBA draft. It was anticipated he'd be the number one pick. He was, and so it seems that what's likely occurred is that he received these loans kind of in advance or against the salary he'd be soon drawing. But that's a violation of NCAA rules because Ed Martin was officially a booster of the athletic program by virtue of having received a comped hotel room for one of the NCAA tournaments, maybe that 93 tournament or the regional tournament or something like that. So he got a hotel room, and that makes him, by NCAA rules, a booster. And then those loans are impermissible. So that's what they got Chris Webber on. Subsequently, Chris Webber also lied to a grand jury, and so there was a whole different legal thing, but that's a separate matter. The NCAA thing were these loans that he received from Martin.
After playing his final game.
Exactly.
It's unbelievable.
And for our listeners to also understand, as soon as you play your final game, a lot of players sign with agents. And those agents give you enormous amounts of money,
exactly.
Against the salary that you're going to make.
Right, and yes, that's important to point out.
Yeah, exactly. So this whole scenario is not something that's uncommon. What's uncommon is that Ed Martin was classified as a booster of Michigan because he one time got a comped
room. Which sounds like a very, kind of intricate detail that...
Sounds like...
I can say that
in front of you, Iago, because I've read your articles.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Well,
here's the thing. Like, I've talked with Ed's son, Carl. He also came to visit my class at Michigan. And
Ed Martin is deceased. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. What seems to be the case, and this is corroborated by Jimmy and by Jalen Rose, is that, Ed Martin had long been a benefactor of disadvantaged youth in Detroit. Some were athletic stars, but not all. And so he was, well known to these guys. And so in a certain way, it's quite logical that Chris and others might turn to someone they trusted rather than somebody that they had just signed with, for example, to help them get by. And to be really frank with you, I think that a big part of the really attack on Ed Martin in this case, I think, has to do with a kind of social collective fear of black wealth and the independence that that affords.
So Ed Martin is African American. Was African American?
Yeah, he was okay. African American. I'm sorry, I didn't clarify that.
No, yet. That's okay. I mean, I think this is all about, you know, this kind of squelching of unapologetic blackness. I mean,
yes.
It's just got it written all over it.
Yes, and the black autonomy and
yeah.
agency.
And it's a tiresome story that repeats itself over and over again. This kind of shaming after the fact, you know, kind of humiliation after the fact when a person has no recourse.
I'd like to share, if I can, one
sure.
anecdote just to give your listeners a sense of how extreme these attitudes can be. In one meeting that I attended at which the issue of restoring the banners was raised and discussed, there was one high-level official from the university administration who counseled against even opening up this discussion and did so on the basis of an analogy with controversies that were then unfolding at Penn State over whether or not to honor Joe Paterno.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah. So I heard this and, you know, really lost it, frankly, and just said, you know, that to begin with, you know, that is not an analogy that holds here.
Not at all.
You know, why is there a controversy at Penn State? Why would anybody, you know, worry about honoring Joe Paterno? Why don't you tell me what the issues are and see if you can really make them stand in comparison to even what has been documented as an impropriety on the part of Chris Webber? And you really want to hold those two side by side and say Michigan shouldn't get involved because it's the same thing as 42 counts
of sexual assault.
Of sexual assault against minors.
Against children.
Well, yeah.
You know,
that gives you a sense, though, of, you know, where this is and how this manifests, I guess,
the thought of criminalization
exactly.
of being black. And so you take alongside that here's a kid who was done playing. He took a loan to bridge the gap between college and the NBA, and that's a criminal offense. I mean,
exactly.
It's just it's the criminalization of being black. That's
right.
What it is.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
As a white guy who came from privilege, I got to tell you, until I was at North Carolina
yeah.
and really saw how this worked, I don't know that I really believed injustices that were that severe happened to people of color. I think there was a part of me that always thought, well, if he took the money, I guess that's what should happen.
Yeah.
I can't communicate to people what injustice these things are. And
yeah.
I just wonder if it was a different player on that team that took a loan, a white player on that team that took a loan from a white person to bridge the gap, if the same scenario would have unfolded.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's hard to know the answer to that question, but I think what you're wondering sort of expresses and points to really is how plausible it is to consider that it wouldn't happen the same way because of the systemic kind of injustices
yeah.
right.
that we've been talking about. So maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but you're... it's understandable that you would wonder.
So,
and I think that, you know, a lot of the students I teach have the same kinds of thoughts initially that you had, that you described having had, John, and that I think I had when I was their age, you know, which is a basic belief that, you know, there are extreme forms of injustice that you might be aware of, but by and large, you feel that the system maybe just works more or less most of the time in a fair way. And I think that for the students I have who are athletes, it gets really tricky to acknowledge this because to acknowledge what happened to these guys is also in a way to confront the fact that the institution that they are sacrificing themselves for may not have their back either.
It's so just anger-inducing for me. What outstanding human beings
yes.
who, absolutely took up space in what they were asked to do with such integrity and such a vision of how what they were doing could have a social impact for the better. I mean, just it's like you would dream of having people like that on your team.
Exactly.
And that they have been shamed by the university, you know, in any way is horrible. But the fact that and you just fill in a little bit for our listeners about what has happened to the kind of quote unquote Fab Five brand at University of Michigan. Talk a little bit about that so our listeners can understand this kind of shadow side of what has happened.
Sure, I can do that. And it's a somewhat complicated story because the Fab Five kind of exist and don't exist depending on where in the university's culture you are looking. It kind of begins in 2002. Well, I guess it begins in the late 90s when there was the whole investigation that wound up leading to Chris Webber specifically and the Fab Five. And then that culminated in 2002 when appointed President Mary Sue Coleman instituted a series of self-sanctions as a response to that investigation. And the most notable of those was the removal of the Final Four banners from the 92 and 93 Final Fours appearances that the team had. And apparently, so a lot of the attention is kind of focused on those banners. As you all know, you know, in athletics, banners in arenas and stadium are kind of the, you know, the currency of history. It's how we remember the great individuals and teams of the past. So that was a really significant symbolic gesture alongside a series of other more kind of less spectacular and substantive gestures. And what I have found now, of course, you know, when I teach undergrads, they were all born after the Fab Five. And they really only came to consciousness after the records were expunged and the banners were taken down. So a lot of them, if they know of the Fab Five at all, only know of the Fab Five through the ESPN documentary. And they're curious, and they usually want more information, and the more they get, the more outraged they tend to be about the treatment that the players received. We have been working partly with the guys, with Jimmy especially, but also with Ray and to some degree with Jalen, and with the athletic director, the new one, Ward Manuel, to see what could be done to find a proper way to honor the athletic and cultural and social legacy of the team. And, you know, as part of that effort, we had this event sponsored by the college at Michigan last October, which was a roundtable discussion that included Jalen, Jimmy, and Ray, as well as Kevin Blackstone from NPR and The Washington Post, and Billy Hawkins, works on college sports from the University of Houston. And so we just had a kind of roundtable discussion open to the public, and it was a very powerful event that really impacted the community, I think. Around that time, there was an election for several open seats on the Board of Regents for the university, and all the candidates for the Board of Regents were asked by a faculty member what they thought of the banners, and every one of them said that they thought they should be restored. In subsequent conversations I had and that I sat in on, it seems that the main obstacle at this point is that the agreement that Michigan signed with the NCAA in terms of the self-sanctions and then the sanctions imposed by the NCAA didn't set any kind of definite time limit. I believe the language in that agreement is that the banners and the other sort of forms of self-sanction will continue in perpetuity. So Michigan's position at the moment, last I have heard, which was probably a couple months ago, was that that's not something they can / are willing to try to change.
Very interesting.
That is a major, major cop out on their part.
Well, that's
because I mean the NCAA has no teeth on something like that.
Well, as I think you all have pointed out on different shows, or some of your guests have, the NCAA is Michigan
the university
and
exactly.
the other universities. So it's a kind of a passing the buck or copping out, as you say.
Yeah.
I think what's more likely to be the case in a way, and this would probably be acknowledged, is that they aren't willing to spend the political capital that it would take to kind of go to battle on this one. Okay.
Can you tell our listeners about this recent kind of appropriation of Fab Five? You know, symbology, and then, you know, kind of coupled with this conversation you've already told us about, it just really stinks.
Right. So Michigan has a contract with Nike that was signed a year ago for $175 million. And most recently, Nike came out with a specially designed basketball shoe called Five Times, called Fab Five. Fab Five. And it has iconography of the symbol of the crossed fingers that the players use to symbolize five times their name for themselves on the sneaker. It's yellow and black, or maize and black, I guess I should say. And apparently it's not going to be retailed. It's just being made for several kind of notable people, DJ Khaled and some other celebrities. I was told that supposedly it was going to be given to the players too, meaning the Fab Five guys. But when I asked Jimmy and Ray, they had never heard anything about it. So I don't think they've gotten their shoe. And, you know, that is the most recent. But at the unveiling of the Nike basketball uniforms last September, they had a case with Fab Five memorabilia. This was a Nike event, not a University of Michigan event, but it was held at the Chrysler Center. And they had Fab Five player jerseys. The guys were there for that. And then as soon as the event was done, all that stuff was wiped away. So it is a really blatant exhibition, I guess, of being willing to trade on the name when it is profitable for the athletic department in some way, and in every other way, completely disavowing the players and the team.
In my line of work, we call that hypocrisy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
That's my wisdom for the day from Yago.
I thought you'd like that.
From Yoga Yago.
Right.
Your name gets auto-corrected to Yoga.
That's what John said. Yeah, there's Yahoo also shows up sometimes.
Oh,
auto-correct. So never worry about that. It's fine.
Well, it's great to hear your voice. And
you too,
hope we can
Thank
talk again sometime
much.
Soon.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Take
bye-bye.
Care.
I mean, one of the things I am just so grateful for as I listen to you both is that you have stayed engaged with young people and with athletes. And of all the conversations I've had with activists around players' rights, this is the one that's going to leave me the most hopeful. And it's because you all do understand what it means to put yourself out there for a greater good, and that is still what you're doing. You're still living out of that spirit, and it really is powerful. I'm so grateful for this conversation. I just can't tell you how inspired I am by both of you, and not only just your story, but your present life, your present level of engagement in what you're doing on these issues.
Everybody's not completely blind and closed-minded. And that's the thing with what Jimmy was saying. It's a lot of people that are woke out here. We got to plug into the people that are woke, that are willing to make the challenge. And I just ask that y'all continue to pray for us, because this journey is painful. It's a lot of hardship in it. It's a lot of pain and anger and frustration. So we're going to continue to pray for y'all and thank y'all for this opportunity as y'all continue to pray for us. Thank you both for having Ray and I on here and, allowing us to share our stories.
It's been a blessing beyond measure.
Thanks, guys.
Thank y'all so
bless
much.
You all. Have a good day.
Bless you. Bless you.
Okay.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. And make sure you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.